Welcome to the Theorist-Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and their compositions. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a graduate music theory student at Florida State University. Today I will be talking with the folk artist Olivia Hunter, who, alongside a handful of her songs, is the featured guest for this episode. We discuss her background, musical training, folk and historic inspirations, artistic process, the folk scene, and much more. So, without further ado, this is an excerpt from the song titled Clementine, and welcome to the TCC. Again, the music that you were just listening to is an excerpt from the song titled Clementine by the artist Olivia Hunter, who, alongside her music, is the featured guest for this episode. That leads me to welcome Olivia Hunter themselves to the program. How are you?
Good, I'm good. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. I will not lie, very stressful time of year, at least for myself as a second year master's student. Doctoral programs lurking around the corner. Got a lot going on, but this is not about myself. How about you go ahead and introduce yourself, Olivia, personally, professionally, academically, whatever you choose.
Sure. I think personally, one of the most important things about me is that I'm part of a pretty big family. I'm the oldest of five kids, and I was homeschooled pretty much all the way up until college. I played band and sports at Newberry High School, and I've always played music with all of my friends and family. I think academically, I can be described as a book freak or a nerd. I study English now. I'm doing a master's program, and I am probably most interested in history and myths and legends, sort of classical things.
So I get this question a lot as a music theory graduate student, and I'm sure you do too. Well, maybe not from your family or friends, I don't know. But so what do you plan on doing with a master's in English?
So I want to be a book editor. My sort of ultimate goal is to edit historical fiction and like adaptations of things and tell people all of the ways that they got the tiny historical facts wrong. So
that's interesting. Interesting. Yeah. And you're unique in a number of ways of all the guests that I've had on here. One, never had a folk artist, and we'll get into how you describe yourself, but not someone whose primary prerogative is music. In your daily life or what you do professionally, where does music lay in there?
I have always played music. I've been writing music since before I could actually write. And I used to think that everybody wrote every song that they were singing. So like, I thought my mom wrote every lullaby that she sang to me. So it's always been like a part of my life. And I think I had a pretty big music community. Our homeschool group was very musical and we did performances for each other. And I think now I get a lot of inspiration for my music from my study. I write a lot of songs inspired by like myths and folktales and books I've read.
Let's talk about that. What kind of myths? What cultures or origins?
Well, mostly Greek, pretty much Greek, and then a lot of sort of fairy tale stories.
Like the Grimm Brothers fairy tales, like German or
what kind older. So like the Irish stories about sort of like abductions and the Tuatha Dé and all of that.
Interesting. I think we brought this up during the preliminary meeting, but I was 100% a Percy Jackson kid. So I knew my Greek mythology forwards and backwards. And once it crossed over into Roman, I started to get into that a bit. I kind of pattered off after a while. So I feel like the story wouldn't end, but you know, it is the way of books, I suppose. So are you now you want to be a book editor. You write music, obviously, which is the focus of this episode, but do you write literature yourself?
Not at all. I have started about 50 little stories and I have finished none of them. I think my attention span is much better suited to sort of poems and songs.
Fair enough. And so let's talk about your music. Your biggest inspirations, as you said, in terms of creativity are from your interest in history and mythology and so on. But how about musical inspirations, other artists, genres? Where do you find your sound?
I think as far as genres go, Irish and Scottish folk traditionals are a big influence on like the musicality of my stuff, the instrumentation. And as far as like the overall sound, some more modern folk artists like Indigo Girls, Brandi Carlile, and Hozier in more recent years. And then I think there's some specific songs that have been influences on me. So like Scarborough Fair and Dolly Parton's Little Sparrow. So yeah.
Great selections.
And some lullabies also, and some old folk tunes. Pretty eclectic, but yeah.
The ones that your mom wrote, right?
Yes, all those.
Yes, I personally, Simon and Garfunkel, Scarborough Fair. Well, I mean, they're not the ones who wrote the original Scarborough Fair. They just did a version of it. But in terms of folk music, I love deeply John Denver. And that's slightly more on the country pop-ish side, but also early Simon and Garfunkel absolutely holds a special place in my heart. I love that kind of sound. And one of the many reasons why I was attracted to your music when I was going through different things on social media. Well, you're one of the guests that I don't really know you, or you don't really know me. So as far as just the introductory meeting that we had, and I would say that your music, at least just sonically, like the sound of it, sounds something similar to Joan Baez. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
I have heard of her.
Yes, it reminds me of that. And on your Instagram, you describe your music as old or traditional. I guess I haven't really heard many people describing their brand new music as that. Is that out of your wish to emulate traditional musics from folk cultures?
I think in part, for sure. I think it is a way of linking myself to the folk music community and like the people who are kind of preserving, especially like the Florida folk traditions. But in a way, it's almost, I think of my music as older than that, even just because it's a way that I reinterpret like myths and legends and sort of historical things. So like my source material is old, I guess.
Sure. I suppose it's different for me because, you know, it's been a while since I've had someone on the show that is, I would describe non-academic based, or someone who's not getting a degree in composition or did get a degree in composition or something of that sort. And there's a constant fighting internally, externally, whatever, in the composition sphere for concert music to not be old sounding, you know, in a way. Not, you know, to say, you know, I write romantic tonal music, but no, no, this is not Tchaikovsky. This is not whatever. There's always this constant fighting to appeal to people who may enjoy older music, but no, don't worry. I'm writing something brand new. And I find it very unique and interesting. And I guess it just shows a different musical tradition that in your space, that's not frowned upon at all.
Yeah, for sure. And I think even a big part of the folk music community is like sort of redoing the old music, retelling the old stories, and like putting your own spin on older music. I think it's like a really important part of sort of keeping the genre alive.
Yes, I really want to go into that right now, but that is more so in the later part of the podcast, because I know absolutely nothing about the folk music scene, especially the Florida folk music scene. I'm interested in that as someone who grew up in Florida and has no idea what that is. But for now, let's move on, or just stay with, maybe not move on, stay with yourself as an artist, although I really want to talk about the industry that you find yourself in. So let's talk about labels. I always find labels interesting. You may not, well, I'm going to ask if you care or not so much, but it's a way to talk about how we perceive ourselves, I think. And so I introduced you today as an artist. And when we did our like preliminary thing, you said you don't really consider yourself a composer. Now, I've had people on who consider themselves producers, writers, artists, sometimes composers, sometimes not composers. How do you see yourself in the art landscape, music landscape? And do these labels really mean a whole lot, or is it different flavors of ice cream, or do you see importance in the distinction?
I think for me, there is some importance in the distinction because I'm certainly not a composer or a producer, or like a music academic or scholar. I would probably primarily describe myself as a writer or a songwriter. And I think artist isn't a bad way to put it. I know a lot of people who just call themselves musicians. And I know people who call themselves tune writers.
Tune writers, that's a new one for me.
Composers. Because I think composition has a lot to do, at least in my understanding, with like actually like writing out sheet music and being very scientific about it.
You know, that there's a lot of interesting connotation there, because that's something that's very consistently debated about in the walls of academia. I can actually say that because I'm in those walls. and it's hard to disagree with what you just said, because in a way, philosophically, I don't agree. But also the reality of how things are treated, presented, and especially perceived, you're not wrong. I always mess with people. You know, I would call Lady Gaga and Pitbull composers. And, you know, there's some cognitive dissonance there, because that's not, especially Pitbull. God love him. And I do. You know, maybe not the first word you would use, but on a fundamental level, you are a composer, you yourself. But there are a lot of connotations that come with that. Like you said, writing, like physically writing the notes and the academic sheen of it and all of that. But so right or wrong, you would choose artist or songwriter for yourself?
I think both. I think those terms, at least in the circles I run in, tend to overlap more. And I think because I do perform my music live a lot, I sort of like step into the art realm.
Sure. And now, since you brought that up, let's bring up the live portion. We're going to be talking about three different songs of yours today. One of them was heard in the introduction, Clementine. We also have You Wouldn't Believe and Icarus. Now, all three of these and everything in your catalog that is available online is all performed live. Again, a little bit different than my personal experiences, and as someone who studies popular music, and although folk music comes from a different tradition, it still is lumped in there, as a little bit different for me, just perceptually. Why is everything that you do as the final recording done live? Is that a traditional thing within the folk sphere?
Well, I think with the people that I know, pretty much everything is done live. I know a lot of people who do produce CDs, but they generally take a really long time. For me, I think a big part of it is just accessibility. We have a really good live recording spot, Heartwood Soundstage in Gainesville, where I've done pretty much all my live recording. And I was able to sell tickets to pay for the cost of like getting the recordings. So it was super like accessible for me as a person who didn't want to pay a studio to do a multi-layer track. And I think for my music, the reason I recorded my first album at all was because my mother wanted a CD of my music to play in the car.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So I think it was like good enough to have it live, and it didn't need to be perfect because it wasn't really for the purpose of selling. Like, I'm not marketing my music to radio stations really, or like the pop industry. It's mostly for me and my family and my community. And I really like to get my stuff down officially so that if ever does want to buy something off of me, they can have something to look at. But yeah. And I think I don't experience my music any other way than live. So like, I don't hear it in my head as a studio version most of the time. For a couple songs, I'll write a song and I'll be like, wow, I'm not the person who should be performing that. That should be for someone else to play. But most of the time, the songs that I write make the most sense, like performed live with friends.
Sure, sure. Well, you would never know that they were not studio produced. As I was commenting before we hit record, they sound perfectly fine in the way that they are. So maybe in this case, not just a fact of accessibility, maybe it's not necessary. Well, I would say in this case, it's not. But and so let's talk about, you talked about right there, the writing process, hearing things in your head. How do you go about writing your songs, tunes, lyrics? And I'm particularly interested in this because I teach the songwriting course at Florida State. And this is something that as my students prepare for their final song project, this is something I'm thinking about a lot, meeting with them in office hours and talking through different methods of songwriting. And I'm not a songwriter or a composer myself, so I'm having to adapt to a couple of things. But what's your artistic process?
Well, the few times that I've actually sat down intentionally to write a song, I have ended up writing a completely different song than the one that I sat down to write. And I think because I do everything by ear, it is really improvisational. So I'll like hear a sort of melody line that's usually associated with words. Or I'll just like have a word or a phrase that kind of gets stuck in my head. And then I think, well, I should probably write this out and put some chords to it. And then I think a lot of my songwriting process is like messing around. It's really rare for me to hear a fully formed song immediately in my head. And I use voice memos a lot. So like I'll think of a melody and I'll just like sort of hum into my phone, and then later I'll figure out some instrumentation that goes along with it. And I have done completely improvisational songwriting before, which is super fun, where I've done it as a performance where like I'll be on stage and I'll be like, can I please have words from the audience? And then I'll just like write a song based on those words. And it's super fun. But I think it is a lot of just like messing around and tweaking things and coming back to stuff later.
Sure, sure. So it sounds like a little bit your melody first.
Often. Melody or lyric.
Melody or lyric. Melody or lyric. Do you take like notes on your lyrics, like passing about, just like you do with your voice memos?
No. I remember words much more easily.
Fair enough. You are an English master's student. Certainly far and beyond what I am in that category. So, is all of this writing done like on a piece of paper and on your phone, or do you use digital audio workstations at all?
It depends. If I am writing something that in my head is for choir, I always use GarageBand so that I can just record harmonies over themselves. But most often, I just record myself in the voice memo app on my iPhone. And if I am somewhere that like I can't make a recording right away, I will write like notes in my notes app, like especially like of the words, or like it's a quiet melody, it's a fast tempo or something. Like I'll just be like vaguely what it sounds like.
So here's a, I've always wondered about this because so it sounds like you're a very intuitive songwriter, or it just, for lack of a better phrase, it almost comes to you when it does, and then you work with whatever comes to you. How do you deal with writer's block then?
Well, I think because I'm not trying to produce a lot of content really quickly, like for sale, it doesn't bother me as much. Like I will sometimes go a couple months without finishing a song, but I don't often get writer's block.
Well, you are blessed.
I mean, I definitely do for like certain things will be harder at certain times. So sometimes I will have a ton of lyrics and I'll just write them as poems because I just can't figure out what they're supposed to sound like. And sometimes I'll have like 10 different recordings of 10 different chord progressions that I know will have lyrics at some point, but don't yet. And right now I have a list of song titles that I was just thinking about in the car, and I was like, this would be a nice song title. And then I just titled a bunch of songs that don't exist yet. So I think like different parts of the process are harder at times, and I kind of just leave them alone when they're bothering me. I'm like, when I've tried to force it, it really has, it just shifts. Like if I sit down and I'm trying to write, like especially if I try to write a happy song, I'll sit down and be like, I gotta write a happy song. I can't keep writing sad songs. I'll like start with the lyric. I'll try to make the chord progression happy. I will utterly fail, and it'll be a completely different song that's like a tragedy.
Thank you for your insight on that. Always something that I'm thinking about now as a teacher. And, you know, it's curious how everyone goes about their different process. So let's pivot to the tracks that we are actually featuring today. I already listed them off, but for convenience, Clementine, You Wouldn't Believe, and Icarus. So let's go ahead and start with Clementine. Can you give us a bit of background on this song?
Yeah, so this song is sort of a reinterpretation or my take on the old folk tune, Oh My Darling Clementine. It's, oh my darling, oh my darling, oh my darling Clementine, you are gone and lost forever, dreadful sorry Clementine, which I hated completely as a child because I felt so betrayed on behalf of Clementine because it's just an infuriating story because she falls into this river. And there's a line in the song like, oh, I was no swimmer, so I lost Clementine. Like he didn't like jump into the river to save her
Oh,
because he was
okay.
swimming. And that's like how I always heard it as a child. And then based diff like different versions are different, but the versions of the story that I heard ended with him not attending her funeral and him getting married to her sister. And so I was just really enraged about it as a kid. And so I just refused to hear that song. Anytime anyone was singing it, I was like, walk away. I was like, I can't even listen to this story. And I can listen to it now because I've written this song. I was like, I need to avenge Clementine. I feel so angry.
Yeah, the lyrics of your version, well, it's not even your version, it's a completely different song, but the lyrics of your response make significantly more sense now. Just like a lot of kids, I really only know the chorus of that, which is the thing that you just saying. I did not realize the content of the verses, like you were just saying, in a way that's almost comical, but it is dark also, because implying that she's dead.
Yeah, I think when I play it live, people do find it really funny, like especially the me telling the story of it, because I think a lot of people like have known that song for a really long time and not thought about it in quite such a bitter way. But I set out to write it with like honest frustration. But honestly, in a way, I'm glad that it is a bit more lighthearted for other people. Like,
sure. Is Oh My Darling Clementine, is that an American folk song?
Yes, it is.
So I remember, I wish I brought to this part of the conference, because it just sparked in my head when you were talking about that. In music history, at University of Florida, there was a portion where we talked about folk writers of the 40s and 50s. Now, of course, Oh My Darling is much older than 1940 and 1950. But about how the lineage of, at least we focus on American folk songs, have themes that are, well, not friendly in the slightest to minorities and women. And that almost smells like that with what you're saying about the original Oh My Darling Clementine. And I'm sorry, I should have thought about this before to prepare you in the notes, but I just find it right now fascinating that in the folk scene, is there any consideration about that, about historical treatment of certain people, whether that be people from marginalized backgrounds or women historically with famous folk songs, a lot of the time being written by men?
Certainly, like absolutely. So the history of folk music is really interesting because it has often been like protest music and like really powerful political statement music. And a lot of songs from the far past are like, as a contrast, super racist and really violent towards women. And I think it is something that the current folk culture, at least the people that I know, like are thinking about, especially like because we play the old songs. And like some people change them, and some people like will eliminate some of the verses, or like I worked at a music camp and there's a couple of older songs that had like been on the program that we were like either needed to take some of the verses out completely or like have a conversation about like why that ended up written and like how culture has changed and how like we don't say some of the things that we used to say anymore.
If you were a curator of one of those events, would you remove the verses, give a content warning, or not program it?
It would depend on the event. So like there's the event I worked at was a summer camp for girls, and a lot of them were like, it's like 10 to 16 was like the age range. And so it depended on the song and it depended on the girls listening. But there's some that's like, there's some language of like assault and violence in a couple of songs, specifically towards young women and girls, that we decided this year, we were like, we don't really want to be singing this like in our group jam sessions. But if questions come up, we'd like about what is in the program, we talk about them. And like, we talk about like, yeah, that isn't actually okay as a thing to be singing now proudly. Like, we don't go about proudly singing them as if they're like something we should be aspiring to. But I think it is important to learn about the history of music and how it's changed.
And so on that history, you know, you talked earlier about wanting to, in a way, sustain that music culture. I don't know the answer to this, and it's certainly not accusatory. This comes from a question of naivete on my part. Can you properly paint a picture of that culture without including the ugly reminders of that culture? In this case, the content that's in the music was in the music.
I think it's a really complicated question.
Oh, sir. And also, if you're not comfortable with it, we also don't need to do it if you don't want it.
Well, let's see if I can answer it.
Okay.
In my own personal opinion, I think painting a complete picture is really important. And the erasure of our history, especially like the history of America and the United States, is super dangerous. And I think it's really important to acknowledge where we came from and all of the things that have happened in this country. And I think folk music is a really interesting scene to do that in because of the like diverse influences, even on very old folk music. Like, there's the African music traditions of the enslaved people and the like English music traditions of the enslavers. And especially in Florida folk, there's like Spanish and Caribbean influence right alongside the like Irish and Scottish stuff. So I think like the music itself paints a really interesting picture of the history. And I think that's really important. And it does bear preserving.
Great answer. Great answer. And I also want to say to everyone that I did not think about this angle of the conversation prior. And so this is mildly sprung on Olivia. And so thank you very much for talking about that element. It's not, again, not accusatorily of the historical preservation. This is also something that I think about often in one of my graduate classes is decolonizing the archives. And a lot is talked about preservation and doing it accurately, but also, I don't know how to fully word it, but just talking about how to preserve history properly and respectfully and maintaining even the bad parts, if you want to generally say it that way. So thank you very much for engaging in that conversation. I hope that wasn't too uncomfortable.
No, I think a lot of reflection is really important too. Like, to just have it without talking about it is also harmful. So I think it's good to talk about it.
So on to the next track or song that we're looking at today, we have You Wouldn't Believe.
I went walking by the water on an evening bright and clear. Saw the lady of the river putting flowers in her hair. And I asked her for direction, for I'd lost the milestone. She said, child, come and join me, and this road will lead you home. And the things that you'll see, well, you will not believe. And the currents will follow wherever you lead. With the earth set in motion, wherever flowers will bloom in the palm of your hand. There were creatures in the willows, and the wind was soft and kind. As I slipped beneath the surface, and I left the world behind. And I carried on my journey through the current swift and deep, till the rushing of the river put my weary heart to sleep. And the things that I saw you would not understand. I saw creatures that feed on the dying of land, and gardens and orchards all long overgrown. And all this in the darkness as I lay alone.
It sounds like something out of a fantasy setting. When I was studying your music, coming up with the questions, my girlfriend came by and she said it sounded like something you'd hear in Skyrim. So you can take that in the way that you will. Certainly the compound meter, the swaying feeling, really helps with that. But can you tell us a bit about You Wouldn't Believe?
Sure. Maybe you can tell me something more about compound meter, because I don't really know what that is. But the background for this song is that it was written for a salon night. So my friends and family, we do these like monthly performance nights where everybody has something that they perform. And this one was for high school graduation. It was a graduation salon. And I was instructed to give a speech or performance of advice to the graduates. And I tried to write a speech of actual advice, which did get written. But then I also wrote and performed this song, which is maybe some more vague advice. Don't let time pass you by, et cetera, et cetera. I think the fantastical element just comes from me because it's sort of the way that I process the real world that we live in is through very unreal medium.
Why is it called a salon?
I believe it was called that because of the French, the older French custom of the salon, where you like perform poetry and do readings, like in a small group setting. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that people still held those sort of things. Shows the different kind of backgrounds between yourself and I. That was the setting in which this was written or performed originally. But what folklore is this based off of? Or what material did you derive to write this?
So this one's actually a hybrid. The Lady of the River in the beginning of the song is a naiad, which is a river nymph. But I think I had her specifically as a nymph of the River Lethe, the forgetting river in the underworld, and that's from the Greek myths. And then the sort of lost time aspect is from the like British fairy tale trope of like losing time or time passing differently when you're like in another world. And I think also I just grew up around a lot of rivers and springs and bodies of water, and they always felt really mysterious and magical and sometimes very threatening, at least when I was small. I think there's a lot of like love and respect in the folk community for the water. And there is like a treatment of it as something that's like really vital to the community and the music in a way. But for me as a kid, I was very scared of the Suwannee River, which because there were alligators in it and because it was brown because of the tannins. And so I would swim in the springs, but I would not like go out into the river.
We'll now move on to our third and final one of the trio of songs that we're looking at today, which is Icarus.
I don't have a single thing to offer you, not a trophy have I won. All I want to be is someone close to you, fly me closer to the sun. I can't stand another night in empty rooms, so I just can't take the wind. 4 o'clock and oh my dear, it's morning soon, just a little bit too late. Heaven above and devil below, darling, everybody knows I'm too ready to let go, ready to let go. Oh, I never meant to hurt you, I just didn't think I'd get this close to you.
At least this one, I looked up the Clementine one. That wasn't too hard to figure out. the one that you just mentioned, or the one that we just did, I had no idea. Icarus is not too hard to figure out what mythology you're basing it on. You know, flying too close to the sun, that phrase comes from the myth of Icarus. And so you use it in a little bit of a different context, though, than, well, that a myth is used to adapt to all sorts of different ambitions and so on. And can you talk a bit about how you do it here?
Yeah, so I actually named this song last, a while after I wrote it, I think. And I think a lot of the reference to the original myth happened sort of subliminally. This song was originally about like fear of failure and not living up to expectations. And I think I was thinking throughout it about like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree and like all of those kinds of sayings. And then after I wrote it, I listened to it back in my voice memos and I realized that it needed to be called Icarus and that really it's like dedicated to him. It isn't necessarily about the character himself, but I think the feeling of being afraid of getting too close to the sun while also wanting to achieve and wanting to like get there is a big part of this song.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I've flown too close to the sun. Oh man, especially right now. Recently going to the Society to talk about myself for a second. Recently going to the National Conference for the first time, Society for Music Theory in Jacksonville. It was a wonderful, beautiful experience. But after networking with a whole bunch of different people of possible PhD programs and, oh my gosh, a lot of not just imposter syndrome, but oh my gosh, am I really doing this?
You know? Yes, I definitely feel that too with the master's program and like all of the papers that I'm writing. I'm writing things longer than I ever thought I would write.
Oh yeah, for a master's in English, like what's a typical assignment for you?
Well, I have a final article to write that's like 20 pages and it has to be very thoroughly researched because it's about Jane Austen. I'm taking a class on Jane Austen because that's my life.
Who's Jane Austen?
That was a joke. Was that a joke?
No.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Okay. She wrote Pride and Prejudice. She's a very popular British novelist.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to get bullied. I'm going to leave that in the episode. I'm going to get bullied for that. Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I thought it was a joke. I've been studying her for months.
I Paul, no. One of the most famous writers. I'm sorry. Anyway, that's cool though. What, like, I get, let's just go on this little tangent. What's the class about other than just literally her, but what's it about?
It is literally about her. We are reading everything that she ever wrote. So from her teenage writings all the way through all of her novels and her letters. We're very thorough in the English department.
That's interesting. That's interesting, because if there was something like that, which there still are, but much less now, if there was something like that in music theory, depending on the execution, it might be seen as problematic. That's interesting. Depending on, you know, oh, there's so many classes, I bet still existing in doctoral programs where it's just Beethoven, or it's just Brahms, or something like that. But interesting. And that probably belongs in a different conversation to go further than that. But oh, man, I really tripped on myself and landed on my face there. Oh, my gosh. Anyways, but one of the most famous novels in history. All right. Anyways, one thing I wanted to ask, this is a general thing for all the songs. So the general setting of the music is singing, guitar, and you have a keyboardist. In Clementine, it is the keyboard is playing like grand piano, or that's the setting. It's supposed to be a piano, but the other ones I believe are on a different setting, I think possibly to double with guitar chords. But when it comes to instrumentation, I'm sure it, from what we've talked about, it's not necessarily at the top of your mind. You're a guitarist and a vocalist, so more than likely you're going to have both of those. But when it comes to adding other instruments in the folk scene, like maybe a drum or I don't know, something like that. Have you ever, what kind of things do you think about when it comes to adding, subtracting instruments and different sounds in your songs?
Well, all of the keyboard setting things come from Victoria Griffin, she plays with me on my album. I think as far as instrumentation goes, I write my songs myself. I often hear like harmonies that I want and I will write down or like not write down, but I'll put down in GarageBand harmonies that I want. And I play a lot of instruments myself, but I can't play them all at the same time.
Oh, why not? Why not? I'm just kidding.
Not enough hands in the world. But I think the way a lot of my songs get sort of rounded out and instrumentation gets added is in group playing, like jam sessions and jams, which has been a really big part of like my personal music experience, is like having music parties where everybody played music together, or just like my family singing together in general. But I think it's also a big part of the folk scene is like a jam circle. Where you like pick a song and then you play that song. Like often it's like, okay, I'll play one of mine and then you play one of yours and everybody sort of just joins in by ear however they want to. And for me, a lot of my songs start out with just me and my guitar, and then other people will want to hear them and then they'll want to play along, and then what they're playing is really gorgeous. And I'm like, okay. You play this in the recording because it needs to sound like that in the recording. So like it ends up being a more fleshed out song just because of like group playing.
Sure, sure. I wish I had those sort of experiences in that group setting playing. That's really cool. And goes to your folkloric inspirations, of course, because throughout the history of music, that is primarily how people outside of institutions, churches, and royalty would learn, play, practice, and spread music. So in the history of the world, it actually is more common.
That's true.
Before we move on to the last part of the podcast, where we talk about even more general things, is there anything else you want to say about any of the tracks that we've done today?
I don't think so. Except for that interview aside, I'm glad that you listen to them and you like them, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a weird thing to fawn over in this sort of situation, but you have such a beautiful voice. I mean, really, I would never take it as you're not someone trying to pursue music as your primary thing. Not to give connotation to people who don't, but I'm really surprised to hear that with how just amazing your voice is.
Well, you know, I do have medically noticeable large sinuses.
Oh, what does that do?
It makes my tone just absolutely gorgeous. Me and my brother and my mom all have these like huge, like we get our dental x-rays. They're like, whoa, your sinuses are huge. You can talk so loud. I'm like, yeah, we can.
Well, that's interesting.
Unrelated to anything to do with music, but yes.
Well, I wish I had bigger sinuses. But anyways, your music really is phenomenal. I feel like there's such connotation given to this, and it's very frustrating. When I say it's easy listening, what I mean by that, it does not mean that for some reason there's such connotation. Well, it's not for some reason. A lot of it is gendered and classist and so on, that highly complex, intense music is somehow superior, which is absolute bullcrap. Just your music is like, when I was first listening to your album, it's so serene at like 11:30 p.m. just playing video games, having it on. Like it, and the house is quiet. But also it's something that you can sit down and really think about and actively listen to. And having music that you can do both with is, in my mind, always a sign of abject quality. So anyway, and on that general thing, interview aside, I love your music.
Thank you.
All right. So we're coming to the last section here. And I'm going to ask you the beautifully broad question that everyone loves who comes onto this show. What does music mean to you?
I wrote down three words. In preparation for this question, and the three words I wrote down were community, expression, and solace. I think music has been a big part of the way that I interact with other people. And so it's like a big part of my community. And then it's also a way that I am able to express myself and like my feelings and my thoughts, not sort of constrained to the rules of conversation. Like I often felt, especially as a child, that I expressed myself most completely in music and that I did not express myself very coherently in conversation. And then as far as solace goes, I've always sung to myself whenever I was upset, which was probably amusing to my mother because I would sing very sad songs about not having what I wanted, or about misfortune, the general misfortune of childhood. I would just sing very, very sad songs about it.
I'm sure she was, I'm sure that was interesting for her.
But yeah, it's music has been sort of like a companion for me since I was really young, and a way that I was able to articulate my own inner experience in like an understandable and palatable way for other people.
It's beautiful. You know, if I can arise to my very dented, overused soapbox, I think that's what makes music and pursuing music, whether professionally or non-professionally, more unique than anything else. Not to delegitimize so many of my colleagues in sense, but when it comes to like implementing math and science into music and getting incredibly technical down to spreadsheets of numbers and so on, we don't make a lot of money doing music. Even studying it at an institution, you don't make a lot. If I want to sit down with charts of numbers and theorems and so on that are so separated from the music, the emotion, the feeling, and the intention, I might as well just go to the biology department. I'll probably make more money. The mathematics department, why am I wasting my time with music if I'm not going to focus on the things that you're talking about? And that's what I love about studying music, is particularly popular music, because it's something I connect with on such a deep level in many ways that you're talking about with other musics. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's what it's all about. Quote the hokey pokey. What were you going to say?
Oh, I mean, yeah, like music has been around since long, long before we wrote anything down about it. And humans have been playing music and being humans for as long as we've been around. And I think there is a lot of value in the like theory and analysis part of it. But I think like at its core, music is about like people and the world.
I completely agree. And so speaking of people in the world, I guess almost in some ways the antithesis, depending on your perspective, what are your thoughts of music theory? Because I also want to say you like did a preemptive warning to me when I first asked you if you wanted to be on the podcast, and then we met for the preliminary. You said, I just to let you know, I don't really think about that, which that's a not uncommon thing. That's very common for people to say, even people who are more academic style musicians who write sheet music most days. And so, yeah, what's your perspective on music theory? You know, when you got the message from me, when you see the name of the program, or even the thoughts of what I might be doing daily in my classes.
Well, I always have said, I don't believe in music theory.
Oh, great.
in a similar way that like, I don't believe in minutes. Like I don't believe in time. Like I don't think it's really standardized, you know? Oh,
that's interesting. I didn't expect that.
That's a whole other debate, because a lot of our standardization of time happened with the railroads. And before that, everybody was like on, like every town was on a different time. And anyway, the historical changing of time is really interesting to me. But I've always thought that music theory was not a real thing. And so anytime anyone tried to tell me like, oh, this is a minor chord, if you just suspend it, if you just change it like a little bit, then it would do this other thing, I was like, no, I don't believe in that. I don't believe in chords.
Okay. Do you still believe that?
I think a lot of it came from not having a ton of formal training and making up my own chords, and going to my mother and saying, "Look, I made up this beautiful chord," and her not having the heart to tell me it was like an E minor. And so she just, I didn't know the names of a lot of chords, and I just made them up. But I do now like understand more the value of music theory. And I do think it's like a really interesting way to look at music. But I still make a lot of theory people mad because I don't want to know what the chord progression I used did for the thematic story of the music, mostly because I've found that the more I know, the more I have to hem myself in the writing process. And the way that it was introduced to me, like the way theory was introduced to me, was like, oh, if you want to write a sad song, you use minor chords. If you want to write a happy song, you use G, C, and D. And so I was like, well, I don't believe that that's real. Like, otherwise I wouldn't be able to write like half of the stuff I write.
Well, that's people who say that don't know as much as they say that they do. Not that I'm the ultimate authority. I mean, I tell my class, you'll probably like this. At the first day of my songwriting course, I said that you need music theory for songwriting, but songwriting is not music theory. Because, you know, my class is essentially an accelerated fundamentals course with songwriting in it, because you need to teach them something to do songwriting for a class of non-music majors. They need something, like, to conceptualize music. And, you know, about sad songs or not sad songs with minor or major chords, I mean, the key of A major, just off the top of my head, there's hundreds of thousands of other examples, but Toto's Africa, Adele's Someone Like You, and John Denver's Country Roads are all in A major, and they all are completely different songs, styles, and emotions. And it's all with the same chords, arranged differently depending on the verses and the choruses. But, okay, in defense of my field or the purpose of music theory, I know you're not telling to my face that what I do is useless. I understand the attitude or the approach that you're having. This is how I explain or talk about the importance of music theory to people who necessarily don't see it, or they ask me what I do. And this is actually great because you're an English graduate student. I'm going to ask you a really stupid question. So you're a native English speaker. Why are you getting a degree in English? You know, I explain it as how in college and in high school, you know, even if you're a native English speaker, you still take English classes. You still learn parts of language. You still learn how to construct a sentence properly. You still learn how to write properly, past just the basics of not sounding like a caveman. You know, you take some level of English in college. Even if you're competent enough in your applications to get in, you still need some further education. You could be the most perfect, pristine trumpet player on the planet when you come into college, but you still need to learn the fundamental nitty-gritty of the language that you're speaking in music, and that's music theory. That doesn't mean that you don't know what you're doing and you're just lucky having played whatever, whatever, whatever. What you're doing is music theory. You know, we, for example, I always bring this up because it was just something that my stupid head was so hung up on in middle school English. I did not understand the point with prepositional phrases. I just didn't understand what it was. I know that's so dumb, but I was fixated on it. And I think back and I look on it and I think, well, I was using prepositional phrases in how I speak all the time. We all do. It's just a normal part of speech. And to me, that's what learning music theory is for people who may not want to pursue it specifically, but it helps you understand the language you already use.
I think that makes sense. I like that.
But what do you say to that? I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I got owned. No.
No. But I mean, look, your view, I totally respect. I get it. We create a connotation for ourselves sometimes. And in many places, it's earned. Because look at you. I mean, you have that opinion of music theory. And you're creating music just as good as anything else.
Yeah, I guess it's like music theory is more easily explained as a way of understanding music than it is as a way of regulating music. And for a
Oh. Mm.
long time, I thought about it in like a regulatory way rather than as like an explanatory way.
Well, if it makes it feel, and I'm not trying to invalidate how you see things, if it makes you feel better, for a good deal of music history, that is true, the regulatory part. So you're not wrong in a lot of ways with that, at least in the past, and there's still some bad apples. Certainly.
Names. No, that
No. You see, I'm filling out applications right now and I want a job at some point. And so, okay, well, I we'll put away my soapbox. I love talking about music theory in this way because a lot of these, as I've repeated, a lot of these connotations are earned through bad scholarship, ignorant scholarship, and the ways that public-facing music theory fails sometimes. I think it's gotten significantly better in many ways over the past couple decades. But so let's talk about something now. Okay. I know a lot about music theory. Yay. Very cool. You would hope. You would hope. Let's talk about something I don't know very much about. And I'm really interested in this, the folk scene. Let's say the industry or the music culture that you come from. I mean, words to describe it are communal in many ways, tradition focused, lineages of musical practice and companionship. But what is the modern folk scene like?
It's definitely not like quite the same as sort of like the mainstream music industry. It ends up being a mix of a lot of people playing for different reasons. So some people playing folk music for their whole lives. A lot of people are either in other fields or are retired and they're playing like for fun. A lot of people are like hippies. I go to a lot of like folk music festivals. And there's still a very strong like hippie vibe, which is nice. And there are a lot of people who are really interested in like preserving and cataloging different musical traditions and historical traditions. And I think it goes surprisingly well, like with the mix of people that are there. It can be competitive and it can be a bit of like an old boys club. Like with who they let into the festivals and whose applications get reviewed. But
Well, hey, can we applications reviewed. So you will, how does that work with festivals?
yeah, so for music festivals, you send in your application. I've done all my applications for the spring festivals now.
Is
So
it like a portfolio, an essay? What is it?
usually you just sort of like fill out a form where you introduce
Oh,
yourself.
okay.
And then you attach clips of you playing music. And if you want to lead a workshop, you describe what workshop you would want to lead. And if you want to like lead a group thing, you describe what group thing you want to lead. Or like if you want to lead an official jam circle, you like describe your jam circle. So like if you want to do old folk tunes or if you want to do like a songwriting swap, or I was in a workshop, I didn't lead it, but I was in a great workshop that was like folk songs written by women, and it was pretty much like all women in the group. There was one man, but people had songs that they themselves had written, mostly, and then some people played songs written by like other women musicians, which was really cool. But anyway, you describe what you'll be doing at the festival, and then you attach some examples, and then you have to turn in a photo and a bio, and it's all very official. And then the organizers of the festival review it, and then they let you know. If you're in and when you'll be playing. And so it's pretty
So
cool.
is there, so I, you know what's really fascinating about that is even though culturally they are quite separated, that's actually really similar of a process to getting onto like classical art music festivals. You know, the portfolio, sending in music, all that sort of stuff, and the different work possible workshops and all that. It's interesting how similar that is. And like you said old boys club a little bit. What are some difficulties in that system? Because you said old boys club, it sounds so similar to current composition festivals. where there's also an old boys club in that too. You know, what are some caveats or, you know, issues in all that system?
Well, as far as festivals go, people know each other, and a lot of people have known each other for a very long time. And so because there aren't a ton of slots for a lot of the festivals, some of them are bigger, and so more people can perform. But for a lot of them, they're smaller and there's less people playing. And so people just pick their friends. They're like, oh, and especially if you've played there before, you can like just be like, hey, friend I have, I want to play this again. And they'll just let you in the next year.
Mm.
I like got my foot in the door at the Florida Folk Festival, which is kind of, I don't know if it is the biggest folk festival in Florida, but it is big. But the Florida Folk Festival in, I always think of it as being in Live Oak, but I think it's probably called High Springs. But Live Oak is where my grandmother lives. And we've always gone to the folk festival every year since before I was born. Like I was in utero, et cetera. And so I applied there first because that's where I knew like what was going on. Like I knew the scene. And I got told, not by anybody at the festival, but I got told, oh, you're applying to the Florida Folk Festival? Like, don't you have to be good to get into the Florida Folk Festival? I was like, yep.
Classic.
I guess we'll see if I'm good. And I did, in fact, get into the Florida Folk Festival.
Jeez.
And so I think from there, I like made friends and got to like know people. And I got asked to play at other festivals. And then I have applied to some festivals and not gotten in. And then like applied the next year with like more professional stuff. So like it definitely can be competitive, but there's also a big aspect of it that's like a really close community, which is like an interesting contrast.
Yeah, there's upsides and downsides to close community. You can find a lot of great support and then also in groups. But so you could still attend these festivals though. You just may not be a performance slot, right?
Yeah. You can always go to the festivals, and a lot of people, like a ton of people, just go to listen and not to play. And those people still participate in the jam sessions and in the workshops. And so you do get to play with everybody, even if you're not like necessarily performing. And I think a lot of people do end up applying so that they can get a nice campsite and get to do the sort of like evening music playing with the rest of the campers. Because a lot of times you get to camp for free if you're a performer. And sometimes you're not even allowed to camp if you aren't performing. And so there's like this little village that happens at night, especially at the Florida Folk Festival, where you like walk around and everybody's playing music and like a different kind of music at like everybody's tents. And so then you just go and join and hang out with people. And that's super fun.
It does sound a little hippie. I won't
lie. It is. It definitely.
That's like the live music scene.
Yes.
Does it translate to recording and commercial sense? Now, it sounds like culturally there is not nearly as much emphasis on commercial success and pushing sales and so on. I'm sure there is for some artists. But from what you're describing, it sounds more from the intrinsic enjoyment of it. But what about the commercial side of your scene?
I don't engage with that as much as a lot of people do. I think there's a lot of like, I mean, everything now is online, and like social media marketing is a big part of every music industry and trying to get your stuff sold at all. But people in the folk scene are definitely still like selling CDs, and there's a lot of like bringing your CDs to your live performance and selling them there. And festivals have, there's like a thing called Friends of Florida Folk, and they sell people's music, like you give it to them and then they'll sell it. And you have to remember to get your CDs back, the ones you didn't sell at the end of the festival, which I often forget to do. I think there definitely is a commercial scene. I just don't think it's as like publicized or something. Like people aren't like hearing about folk music and like folk record labels as much, like if they're not already in the scene.
Look, I don't claim to know everything, but I would consider myself pretty in tap with a lot of different genres, and I can concur. No, I don't hear very much about it either. But well, thank you very much for enlightening myself and the listeners on your folk music scene. It's something that I would wager most of the people who listen to this podcast don't know too much about, and it's a very interesting cultural pocket of the country and the global music scene. I'm sure it's different in the various ways in other countries as well. But we're coming to a close now, for the most part. And so you are an English graduate student, recording artist in some ways, songwriter, lots of different things. And, you know, I just saw that you did go to the Florida Folk Festival not that long ago. But what do you have coming up? Big projects? You're coming to the end of your own semester, just as all the students are pretty soon. So you have projects and papers and so on, all those beautiful objects. But let's say more in the musical sense, anything big coming up?
So I actually have a second album that's coming out, I hope this winter, that it doesn't have a name yet. My first album is Thoughts About Life. And my second album, I'm not going to call it Thoughts About Death, but it is.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting that.
But I do have a second album coming out this winter with my friend Victoria Griffin being support. And it's live recorded at Heartwood. And it's really great. Go listen to it. Here's the marketing part of the industry. No. But we recorded it like early this year. And so it's been a long time since I have like done the actual recording. Yes, it is definitely a project that is still in the works and coming out soon. And then also, I have done all my applications to do in the spring. So assuming that I get into any of them, I will be performing at festivals in the spring.
Sure. And so this winter, so you're saying that the album will be publicly available before the end of the calendar year?
Whoa. Yes. Here, okay. Let's go with yes on that.
Let's go with yes. Time frame, maybe, other than in the next month and a half?
I mean, we could just say December.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's, yeah, okay. That's a little bit more accurate, a little bit closer. Well, I'd love to promote it once it comes out. Are the tracks featured in this episode going to be on it?
Yes, all of those songs are on the album.
Awesome. And I guess I should have said this earlier, but audience, this is unreleased music that you're listening to in this episode. So thank you to Olivia for sharing that. I guess you could say this is in promotion of the upcoming album, vaguely in December, but I'll make posts on the social media accounts that I have when that comes out. I'd love to support the people who come onto the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. And so what would be the best way for people to contact you with any comments or questions?
I have a website. It's just oliviahunter.com. Olivia starts with an A. And I do have an Instagram, which is Olivia Hunter Music, or at Olivia Hunter Music, I guess. And those are probably the two ways that I exist the most often.
Excellent, excellent. And those will be in the description of this episode as well, regardless of the platform that you are listening to. And so now we are at the close of the podcast, and I love to give the guest the final word in terms of what we're talking about. So if you were to say to the audience anything about life, music, writing music, anything in general, anything else you want to add from what we've talked about today?
Well, thank you for having me. I think this is a really cool project, and I'm glad to have been included. I think if I could give a message to the world, I would just say, like, play music and experiment and mess up and have fun. And I know it's easy to say as a person who is, like, not super in the industry, but I think it's easy to get caught up in producing perfect content really quickly. And it's especially something that we think about a lot with how fast-paced the world is getting. But music does happen in community and in the context of other people, and it can be really rewarding to play without expectation of perfection and to just have fun with it.
Wonderful. Certainly a lesson myself and all of my music colleagues need to hear more often. I can assure you of that. All right. Well, you know, thank you very much, Olivia Hunter, for coming on to the Theorist Composer Collaboration. This has been a great conversation about a pocket of music that, at least in the context that I usually exist in, is not brought up too often. So I'm very happy to have you on to discuss all of that. And yeah, thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Fall so far from you. I don't have a single thing to offer you. Not a trophy have I won. All I ever need is to be close to you. Fly me closer.
Hello, this is Aaron again, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Olivia Hunter for coming onto the podcast and for sharing all of her songs. Olivia's contact info is listed in the description, and I would appreciate it if you could show her some support. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you can click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. Again, make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms, because you won't want to miss any of it. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.